The other bill that's out there that a lot of people have talked about is the Journalism Competition Preservation Act, JCPA. And that's really designed to level the playing fields that we face with Google and Facebook. You know, we talk about digital advertising growth. Unfortunately for us, at least, the fastest areas of growth in digital advertising are in search and social. And our margins in those two pieces of business are terrible. We're in a 10% range for search. So, you know, the rich get richer because Google takes the lion's share of those dollars and Facebook does the same thing for social. And, they're killing us. And so hopefully this bill gets passed, which would give us the collective bargaining against them to try to get compensation for content that they've been using of ours for years that they leverage to their benefit and not to ours.
Welcome to the News Nirvana Podcast. I'm your host, Nick Parker. The News Nirvana Podcast features conversations with media professionals from across the country, highlighting our ever-evolving business models and showcasing the strong and effective journalism produced each and every day. This podcast is made possible to you by the generosity of Town News. Town News delivers solutions, services, and guidance empowering local media organizations to thrive in an ever-changing digital world. Contact Town News today to learn more how they can help you thrive. Connect with them at townnews.com. Alan Fisco, president of the Seattle Times and CFO, also president of America's Newspapers. Welcome to the News Nirvana Podcast.
Oh, thank you. Pleasure to be here. Looking forward to our conversation.
I want to talk to you a little bit, not just about your career there in Seattle and what's going on with the Times, but also we're going to dig in a little bit on America's Newspapers and the advocacy work you're doing for the industry. But let's start with Seattle. You've been there 20 plus, almost 30 years, I think is what you told me. That's your career.
Yeah, it pretty much has been. it's 29 years ago, I started in the circulation department as a single copy sales manager, and I've had the opportunity to run that department and then corporate marketing and advertising, just kind of bounced around and took on more responsibility over the years and became president here about 5 years ago.
I see that you look like you are still, you are joining me from your home. I'm in the Kansas City area. I've just been back in my studio for a few weeks. Are you still working remotely?
Yeah, we're working remote, obviously, other than the production and distribution folks. But yeah, everybody's still remote. We're planning on going back into the office after Labor Day. It'll be on a voluntary basis, give people 3 or 4 months to kind of adjust, and then we hope to get back to some degree of normal the beginning of next year.
How has that switch been? I mean, I think a lot of us kind of learned that we can, not only can we do things, but sometimes we find new and better ways to get stuff done.
Yeah, I think we've done a really good job. Our folks have been incredibly adaptable and flexible, and it's worked well on our part. And it's worked so well that we've really kind of redesigned our entire strategy for working in the office. We're going to have a small group of people who are there 5 days a week, and most people will be in the office maybe a couple days a week and working remotely 2 or 3 days a week, and then a group will be fully remote. So it really allowed us to kind of revisit everything that we've done traditionally, and we've reduced our footprint as far as our lease is concerned. We've consolidated from 3 floors of the building that we were leasing down to 1 floor. So,
well, that's
some
that,
savings there as that, well.
As CFO, that makes me pretty happy.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
If you can help that lease agreement out, you're feeling pretty good.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, and it, just the thought of getting back every day and getting in traffic and the commutes, and that's been the really one silver lining of this whole pandemic is, it's kind of nice to have the flexibility of working from home.
I had for another podcast that I do, I had a guest about 3 or 4 days ago in the studio with me for the first time in about a year, and it took me a good 15 minutes to feel comfortable asking questions again with the person in the same room. It was such a different switch after this for 16, 18 months, right?
Yeah, exactly. I had somebody come up to me last week to give me a hug, and it was one of those moments. It's like, oh my God, this feels really odd and awkward, but it's like, okay, we're kind of getting back to normal here.
There is that awkward moment, and then, oh, that does feel good.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. We had record heat here. You may have seen a couple of weeks ago. It was right up to 105 or 106, which is crazy for Seattle. And we opened up the office for people who didn't have air conditioning in their homes. And there were probably 50 people there that, you know, as I was kind of walking through, checking people out. And it was so great to see people again. That's the big piece that we miss, is that, you know, face-to-face interaction. It's Zoom is nice. Zoom and Teams are, you know, it's productive, but certainly miss that face-to-face.
No, I would say that's the thing I miss the most too, is just having the buzz of other people near me.
Yep, exactly.
Well, this is going to be a pretty open-ended question. I just did. In Seattle at the Times, what's some exciting stuff that you and your paper have going that kind of really gets you, as you're looking to plan and get people back in the office and find whatever our, I know we're all tired of saying it, but whatever our new normal is going to be. I mean, are there some exciting programs and things going on at the Times?
Yeah, there are. There's a number of them. I think first and foremost at the top of the list has been the tremendous growth that we've seen in our digital subscription totals and digital subscription revenue as a result of the incredible news year that we had last year with the pandemic and with the elections and with social unrest. We had record traffic and record digital subscriptions, so we're kind of enjoying the fruits of all of that this year because the retention on those new digital subscribers has been really good. The other area that we're really excited about is the public service funding, our community service funding that we've got. We've got a variety of funding mechanisms in place, from corporations to wealthy individuals to foundations, to support a number of specific content areas. One is homelessness, one is traffic, one is education, investigative journalism, and we just launched a new program, or about to launch a new program. We got little over $1 million from the Ballmer Foundation to support a 2-year effort on mental health issues, local mental health issues. So we're excited about that. We got a $1 million grant from Microsoft Philanthropies to support 3 newsroom positions for 2 years to look at particularly kind of the local economy and local politics as we come out of the pandemic. So that area has really been something that we're proud of, and it really allows us to now expand our newsroom. We're actually on a hiring spree to expand our ranks within the newsroom as a result of the success that we've had with some of this kind of alternative funding approach.
I feel like that's almost a rare thing to hear about, that a major metro is adding to their editorial staff.
Yeah, we're one of the few, and we're proud of it. Very.
I mean,
proud
you just said just hiring spree.
Yeah, well, we had 16 positions we were hiring within the newsroom. I think we're down to we filled about 10 of them, but we still got some openings that we're working on. So, any talented journalists out there, give me a call if you're interested.
There you go, and we're gonna
put in my plug.
Well, we're gonna plug your contact info here in a little bit anyway. So yeah, I think. Saying that you've got positions available, that's fantastic.
Yeah,
I want to talk a little bit about that. You know, the public service, the community service, and the social type reporting that I think all of us across the country are finding is more and more important. It's also, as you alluded to, it's also bringing in the reader, the readership. In Seattle, you've been digging deep for about a year now, really, just based on, as you mentioned, the unrest that was happening in your area. Can you tell me a little bit about how your paper responded to that? Because that's not an easy story to cover.
No, it's not. And again, I don't directly oversee the newsroom, but you know, it's a challenge to be working remote as a journalist because you don't get that face-to-face contact. We did send people out into the field, you know, when we were having the protests and some of the really violent things that were happening locally, which is unfortunate. But you know, we got to the point of buying those people who are out in the field helmets and shields and, you know, things that I never thought in my life that we would ever be dealing with.
What was your reaction when that, you know, that request crossed your desk? As
it was, you know,
to purchase?
I, to be honest with you, I think I had to get rid of this phone call here. Excuse me. To be honest with you, at first I was like, they're completely overreacting. And that's easy to say when I'm upstairs in my bedroom, because, you know, I'm not in the field and seeing what's going on. But once I saw what was actually going on in the field, and I was in the office one day when they were handing out helmets and all, I just was stunned, and very necessary. And it was a thing that really helped. We got to the point where we even had some guards that were out in the field with them, protection people. It's a crazy world. I never thought I'd be dealing with that.
Right, right. As you look into, all of these things, I think can be related. But did that help you as you looked into some of these other topics that now you're expanding your newsroom, you're expanding your kind of not really expanding, but you're focusing a big push of your staffs on these topics of homelessness, on, you know, the politics and what's going to happen after not just the pandemic, but after what, you know, after the social unrest that you've just seen in your communities.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, well, we've seen, you know, tremendous reader response to the coverage of those particular areas, as well as, financial support that's come as a result. The need is there, and the need is there in every community. It's not just Seattle, and the important role that newspapers play. It's kind of sad to see what's going on in the industry with the defunding of newsrooms and, you know, newsrooms of decent sized communities that have five people in the newsroom. I mean, it's kind of a joke to say that you're actually an existing newspaper. That's why we're lucky to be where we're at and really thankful to be in this position where we can expand our ranks.
Well, let's tie this into your side of the business though. Are you seeing that this kind of good reporting and good work, that it's not just bringing the readers? I mean, you just said you're finding people that are willing to spend the money to subscribe to or to help fund. So how are you kind of making that link? Because I think that link is something that so many media organizations are really struggling to make.
Yeah. So definitely the link is working, and it's working for us. We added about 25,000 digital subscribers last year. So we are up to about 75,000 or so digital subscribers. It's the first year. 2020 was the first year where our digital subscription revenue exceeded our digital advertising revenue. And we're in a unique position where about 69% of our total revenue comes from, we call it audience revenue, combination of print and digital, which has really helped us kind of weather the storm that everybody's been dealing with over the past year with advertising revenue that's just gotten decimated. We have two smaller newspapers in Eastern Washington that are much more dependent on advertising revenue than we are here in Seattle. And we lost money in both markets last year for the first time. It's a real challenge in those small and mid-sized markets these days.
How are you, I guess kind of more specifically, how are you taking advantage of that readership that's coming along so that you can convert it into you know, subscription retention, converted into, I don't know if you are doing some of the, a lot of papers are doing the donate to support journalism buttons on their websites that seem to be working in a lot of markets. So what are some of the things you're doing to take advantage and physically make those links?
We don't do the donate button on our site, but we do a lot of other things. I mean, it really starts with kind of the day-to-day nuts and bolts. Every day in newsrooms, they're going over which stories performed well, which stories have not only performed well with page views, but now we can actually identify which stories drove digital subscriptions. And we measure them in three different ways. So if you read a piece of content and you subscribe digitally within 30 days, that's kind of one level. The second level is if you read a piece of content and subscribed within 7 days, and then the kind of the holy grail is, did you read a piece of content and immediately go to subscribe? And so every Wednesday, there's a meeting with the newsroom, with me, with our product people, our marketing folks, our audience people, and we go over the week as to what performed well, how did it perform, what's moving. And it's that kind of day-to-day activity that goes on through the collaboration that we've got with not only news, but with product and with marketing and with our audience folks working hand in hand, that really leads us to understand what moves the needle, what doesn't move the needle, and gives us the opportunity to then to both capitalize on growing new subscriptions, but retaining subscribers and customers as well.
Are you looking at that kind of data more now than in the past?
Yes. I mean, we started it about 4 years ago. But you know, now it's finally gotten kind of inculcated into the fabric of what we do on a day-to-day basis. It's taken us a while to get there, but it's working, and it's working really well.
Is that kind of the secret to really using data, is the just to keep pushing until it becomes a natural part of your workflow?
Yes, definitely so. And it's not easy. You know, I mean, it's you know, when we first introduced this in the newsroom, newsrooms typically didn't really have metrics. You know, it was all, you know, reader feedback. You know, I got 2 phone calls from readers who were pissed. So, wow, you know, I would hear these kind of qualitative things out of the newsroom and out of folks who worked in news about, you know, God, subscribers really loved it, or subscribers really hated it. And I say, well, how many calls did you get? Well, 2. I'm like, well, you know, that's probably maybe a little bit overstated, but yeah.
You mean anecdotes in the news gut aren't what we should trust?
Well, to some degree, yes. But certainly when you look at that against the metrics that we have in place now, it was a game changer for us. Absolute game changer.
When we talked before we got on to record this, you had mentioned to me that some of what you were doing for your reader strategies to use that to bring in revenue. Can you tell me a little about what you're doing specifically?
Well, for reader strategies, we've got newsletters. We've got 8 or 9 newsletters that have been incredibly productive. We do alerts. We're looking for every opportunity to try to understand what people are interested in and pushing content out to them in a proactive way, rather than waiting for them to come to us. And so there's a variety of techniques that we use. The news alerts and the newsletters are key to that. We have 2 teams now. We have a morning team and an afternoon team within the newsroom that really focus on developing that morning brief, which is our most popular newsletter, developing a unique piece of content that's included in that newsletter for the first time. So that's how people are seeing it for the first time, not on the web or obviously in the pages of the print newspaper. They're looking at what's moving on social, constantly refreshing the homepage. And it was so successful with the morning team that we just expanded and created an afternoon team. So these folks are getting in. The morning team is usually in at about 5 in the morning. So by noon, they're done. And now we have an afternoon team to pick it up so that we can maintain not only that freshness on the homepage, but really look for opportunities to push content to readers in the afternoon and evening hours as well.
How many different ways are you pushing stuff out? I mean, there are so many options now, as a small one person newsroom, I get overwhelmed by all of the options. But I mean, you know, you can do push alerts, you can do newsletters. How many ways are you guys tackling?
Well, we do the email newsletters, we do push alerts, we do the homepage curation and constantly refreshing it. I think those are the biggest ways and the most successful things that we've got in place to do that.
So how are you, and now let's go to that shift part. How are you using that to bring in revenue? What is your strategy and your play there to turn readership into revenue?
So, from the newsletters, it's a twofold, and we measure this on a monthly basis. So, obviously it's how many people are signed up for the newsletter, what's the open rates, all of that. But we also then measure the advertising revenue that we get as a result of this, because there is an ad placement on the newsletters themselves. But we also then measure specifically what response we've gotten from the newsletters as far as digital subscriptions. So every month we get a report that shows all of the kind of classic metrics for newsletters, but also shows advertising revenue as well as audience revenue that were generated that particular month from each of the newsletters. So that's just one way that we're trying to get a handle for the success of this and really trying to measure and monitor the impacts both on the advertising but audience revenue sides.
Another thing that you mentioned earlier that I was really intrigued by, and I think this may just be me, but I felt like it went against everything I've been hearing for the last few years, you mentioned that the way you were looking at things, that it looks like the metros right now are actually faring better than the smaller community newspapers. And I feel like that's not the narrative that we're all hearing. And so that struck me a little bit. And I kind of wanted to know why you thought that, why you're reading it that way.
Yeah. Well, what's happened is I think the metros have done a much better job in growing digital subscribers, having the technology in place to really allow for that growth. I mean, when we started down the path of a paywall, the subscription process was 24 steps. So, I mean, yes. We were torturing people to get them to the finish line. And now it's, you know, you can do it in one step or two steps, as little as two steps. And that's a big investment. That's an expensive investment that we made, and other metros are making them as well. We spent multiple millions of dollars in our e-commerce system. But that's hard to really do in a small and mid-sized market just because you don't have the scale. So those small markets, at least, you know, in our areas, and with our smaller newspapers, they're far more dependent on advertising revenue than we are. In Seattle, 70% of our revenue comes from audience. If you look at our small papers, it's maybe 30 or 40%, and that's kind of the typical thing. So as the advertising continues to get hammered, advertising revenue, and now we're seeing preprints almost disappear, it's in the next category that's getting hurt, they're much more dependent on ad revenue than the metros are. And so, you know, they're struggling more and more, and, you know, that's why we're seeing more and more news deserts and, you know, newspapers that are just closing up. Can't even find a buyer these days in some markets.
What do you think the next kind of shift and push needs to be? I mean, like you just said, you know, those preprints are all but dead now. They're on the way. And we watched, you know, we watched classifieds die. We watched inserts die. Right.
So national advertising went away.
So what is the shift? I mean, that you're seeing maybe we need to be making or pushing, you know, what's the thing that we need to figure out and push more? I mean, you know, we learned very early on, you can't sell digital ads the way we sold print ads. And we're figuring all of those things out. Where's our next shift?
I think we're seeing it already. I think the next shift is a decline in print frequency. And, you know, unfortunately, what I'm seeing kind of in the industry is that strategy, that change is being driven by a cost containment strategy rather than this is really how the market's evolving. You know, if you look at our 7-day print subscribers, you know, it's like 80% of them are age 65 and up or so, you know, in that ballpark. We're not replacing those. So, you know, they're going to go away. And the question becomes, and we're already starting to see it, is I think the biggest challenge we're going to have in the near future is the ability to afford to deliver a paper 7 days a week, because household penetration is declining. So routes are getting bigger, and you know, you only have so many hours a day to deliver newspapers if you want to get them there at a reasonable hour. And that's going to, I think that could force the shift to what I think is going to be, you know, I still see, I think our future here is in Seattle ultimately will be a 1 day a week print product, i.e. Sunday or Saturday, a weekend print product and digital. And, you know, when you start to look at the financials around that, it's a pretty compelling financial story to get to, or once you're there, the issue is how do you get there? You know, do you go from 7 days to 1 day? Do you go to 7 days to 3 days to 2 days to 1 day? And that's kind of what we're still working on.
Right. You know, I almost feel like it's time us old print guys, you know, embrace that a little bit. And my joke has always been that nobody fought the internet harder than the newspaper industry.
Right.
Back in the 90s and early 2000s. Are we there where we just need to embrace that shift that everybody's been talking about but us?
Yes. Yes. I think yes, yes, and yes.
Go ahead.
I think it's going to be sooner than people think. Let's put it that way.
The News Nirvana podcast is brought to you by Town News, the creators of IQ Audience Plus. IQ Audience Plus replaces your old school, one-size-fits-all paywall with a smarter metering solution that targets visitors with custom offers, converting drive-bys into paying subscribers. Learn more at townnews.com/audience.
How hard is it for you to think about taking a major paper like Seattle? And I mean, you just said, I see it as being a 1 day a week print. And is that a hard thing to say out loud? Or are you there already personally?
I'm there already personally. I've been there for a number of years, and I just think now it's a matter of a when, not if. Our market, we're not quite ready yet, but I think it's inevitable and it's coming.
Can we?
And it is hard. I mean, frankly, I mean, the thing that's hard is you're doing something like that. You're betting the franchise. You know, if it works, great, and if it doesn't work, then you'll read about my retirement. Excuse me.
You know, can we still make the revenue that we need to make to fund good, important journalism? Can we find that shift? Yeah. Because I think that's the thing that makes us all fight so hard, especially, like I said, us olds, is that when we first started doing it, we realized very quickly we couldn't do the same kind of rates. We couldn't sell it the same way.
Yeah.
Are we getting to a point where we can still fund the journalism that needs to happen?
And again, I'll come back to metros versus the smaller communities. I think in metro areas, yes. I think it's definitely doable. And we've done some financial analysis that says, yeah, it's very doable. My concern is with those smaller communities. Some of them aren't as digitally sophisticated as the Seattle market is. We still have broadband issues in many areas of the country, sadly and unfortunately. So, that concerns me from an industry standpoint is really those small papers and their future existence, which is one of the reasons that, putting on my America's Newspapers hat, one of the reasons that we're so busy and active in trying to get some support for newspapers, both in the near term as well as the long term, because it's definitely needed. And without it, I'm concerned that we're going to have a lot more news deserts.
Well, and that's the segue I wanted to make, and I wanted to use something you said early on today when you were first talking about what was happening out in Seattle, and you mentioned alternative revenue sources. You talked about getting some grants. You talked about some partnerships, like with Microsoft, to fund some of these things. Are we starting to find those creative partnerships and things now so that we can fund those?
Yes. Yeah, we are. And Yakima is a great example. So we, and a partnership with Microsoft and the Yakima Valley Community Foundation, we've had a couple of meetings where we're looking for community support. And the model that we're looking at here is that, if we can raise X amount of dollars from the community, say $1 million, we're going to use that money to expand the newsroom. And those particular positions that are funded by the community, we will make sure that all of that information is available for free to the community. So it'll be in front of the paywall as part of that kind of community service. And then we'll still have other topics that are behind the paywall. So we'll have a combination of free and paid. We've had a couple of really good meetings. There's a lot of interest locally. We've got another meeting next Thursday that I'll be in Yakima for, with a group of about 20 younger millennials to talk about the issue and to try to build up some more interest in what we're trying to do there. But it's a way that we can help sustain journalism in a market that if we were to have to shut down, there's nothing there. I mean, there's a radio station with one person who does some news reporting, but also is a DJ and does 8 other jobs. So hopefully, that's just one example of, I think, the direction that we can take this.
Well, let's shift into your, you can switch hats, put your America's Newspapers hat on. And let's talk about the advocacy. You are currently president of this association. And so let's talk a little bit about the advocacy that you're doing. And I'm going to start off with something you had mentioned earlier. You've actually been pushing, working, lobbying to get a bill through Congress.
Correct. Yeah. It's called the Local Journalism Sustainability Act. It was introduced by Congresswoman Kirkpatrick and out of Arizona, and Congressman Newhouse out of Central Washington. So we've up to, I think, 28 co-sponsors with another group of co-sponsors. Hopefully we'll get the list tomorrow. But it's a really critical piece that I think can help kind of sustain and protect communities like the Yakimas of the world that we've been talking about. So there are three components of the bill. The first component is a newspaper subscription credit. So if you subscribe to a newspaper, you can get a credit of up to $250 annually on your taxes. The second component is actually the journalist compensation credit. So it's a refundable tax credit to newspapers. That would, in the first year, be up to $25,000 per newsroom employee. And then in years 2 through 5, it drops to $15,000 a year. It's designed to cover 50% of the compensation, with that cap being of $25,000 in year 1 and then $15,000 in years 2 through 5. The other thing that we really like about this bill, it's a 5-year runway. So it gives us a little bit of time to complete kind of the digital transformation and some of the issues that we're talking about. And this just isn't a one-time thing. The third component here is a local advertising credit. So if you're a local advertiser with employees of 50 or less, you would qualify for a $5,000 in year 1 and $2,500 in years 2 through 5 tax credit for any advertising that you do in local media. So it's kind of an incentive for the small businesses to advertise as well. So, you know, we're excited about that bill. That bill is going to give us, you know, the immediate support and help that we need. The other bill that's out there that a lot of people have talked about is the Journalism Competition Preservation Act, JCPA, and that's really designed to level the playing fields of that we face with Google and Facebook. You know, we talk about digital advertising growth. Unfortunately for us, at least, the fastest areas of growth in digital advertising are in search and social. And our margins in those two pieces of business are terrible. You know, we're in a 10% range for search. So, you know, the rich get richer because Google takes the lion's share of those dollars, and Facebook does the same thing for social. And you know, they're killing us. And so, hopefully, this bill gets passed, which would give us the collective bargaining against them to try to get compensation for content that they've been using of ours for years that they leverage to their benefit and not to ours.
I think you're right. A lot of us have heard about that bill. Where are we at in that process?
So
these aren't fast games.
No, they're certainly not. And actually, from one of the things I've learned over the past few years in dealing with some of these advocacy things, nothing happens quickly in DC. So certainly it's the long game as far as Google and Facebook's concerned. So it's been introduced. Bipartisan, Klobuchar and Cicilline and Buck and Kennedy, they're hopefully getting it to markup in the process of trying to get the bill to the floor, and that should take place probably right after the recess. They have the August recess where everybody goes home, so hopefully we'll get into markup September, early October. And there's got to be within this pressure on Google and Facebook to come to the table in a specified period of time, because what they'll want to do is litigate it for years and years and years and years and years and years, and that's fine. In the meantime, you know, there are fewer and fewer newspapers out there.
Yeah, they can outlast a lot.
Yep. Yeah, certainly can
a lot. What's your timeline on the other? Where are we in that? I feel like that one is a lot more complicated and might take even longer. I could be wrong.
Yeah, you know, who knows? But the first one that I talked about, that the Journalism Sustainability Act, it has been introduced. We are actively working with a variety of groups to get more co-sponsors in the House. We are working with Senator Cantwell, who is hopefully going to drop something similar in the Senate in the next few weeks, but I'm not 100% sure yet. So. I think, you know, I'm confident both bills will pass. Clearly, I think that the Local Journalism Sustainability Act will have more benefit right away as soon as it passes with Google and Facebook and, you know, deal with all of their shenanigans.
How has that been for you and your association team to work with Congress on these, because I think a lot of us feel like the media has become a pretty good tennis ball in a lot of political conversations. So I mean, has it been a tough needle to thread to get in and make this kind of a pitch and talk about the role that we play and how important it is?
It has been. And one of the things that we've been really advocating with America's Newspapers to our 1,600 plus members is get a relationship with your local legislators. Because, you know, the first time you walk in and they don't know who you are and you have an ask in your hand, that's not the way things work. So, you know, it's far more important that you have some kind of a relationship or understanding with them that you can then have decent conversations with. So that's been a challenge. You know, and the other challenge is just trying to herd the cats of, you know, you look at our industry and you've got privately held, you've got hedge funds, you've got publicly traded, and, you know, sometimes those groups have divergent opinions as far as what they need or what they want.
You kind of on that similar thing, I think just, and I want to use this podcast a little bit to talk about that, is you know, there has been a big narrative, mostly stirred by political talks, though, about mistrust, about that level of trust between media and the people and the communities that they cover. What are some things that you see where we can push back on that a little bit and show the role and the jobs that we're doing?
That's difficult. I mean, I think we need to stay true to our mission. You know, in Seattle, it's the community service through quality journalism and making sure that we are doing our best to be not biased. You know, I mean, there's going to be bias in everything, unfortunately, but really, really examining hard. And I think that's something that our newsroom does a great job with. The polarization of politics is so horrific. You know, they depend on falsities in some cases to get their bully pulpit going. But, you know, I don't know how we change that. That's tough. I think, you know, incrementally, we just need to make sure that we're doing our part to make sure that we are not falling into the trap of what you see with Fox and CNN. And I wish they would not call those news outlets, because they're opinion outlets. They're not news, and that's part of the problem we've got.
Yeah, I always feel like, and I'm wondering your thought on this, that there has to be some better education on our part, because when you see the complaints, right, you read the complaints or you hear people, and I always want to say, well, that's really, it feels like it's more on the consumer, the news consumer, because there's a difference, like you just said, between a reporter, an analyst, a columnist. But, you know, the party, the talking head from a party that's coming on a show where we're, you know, we're a show that is, its whole purpose is to both sides, right? And I had with a local guy here, I had a conversation, and it was difficult for me to talk about how sometimes it's not a both sides story. There's just truth.
Right. Yeah.
Exactly. And so what onus do we have, I guess, to educate the news consumers as to what we're doing and how this works?
Well, I think it's to our benefit to educate them so that, you know, if people do understand the difference between news and opinion. I think that it is a really difficult message to get across. You know, we constantly talk about the firewall that we have between our opinion, our editorial section, our editorial pages in the pages of the newspaper. We've been doing this for 30 years, and there are still many people, unfortunately, who don't understand the difference in the delineation between the two. You know, I think that, you know, the other issue, kind of sidetracking here a bit, is more and more we're seeing issues with open records requests, you know, and I think that, you know, there's being fed to some degree by the politicians who don't want to be held accountable. And, you know, one way to do that is to make sure that we can't get our hands on information that we need to hold people accountable. We had, you know, our unrest here in Seattle. It turns out that the mayor and the police chief who had resigned weren't keeping their texts. So they deleted them after 45 days. Nobody understands how it happens. Nobody's taking responsibility for it. You know, the mayor got a new phone and didn't realize the setting was such. We sued the city for open records over that, and they countersued us 2 days ago. So it's like, what? They admitted this happened, and yet they're countersuing us for coverage of their legal fees in this process. And it's just one of the assaults that we're seeing on our industry, that it's a kind of a sad state of affairs.
Is there any way to combat that without just hoping you have the funds and the time to hold out?
Yeah, we've talked about this. And one of the things that we're talking about is actually creating kind of a scorecard of, here's the number of open records requests that we have made that have been in, not been responded to. Because I think our reader, I was surprised to hear how many there were. And I think our readers would be as well and would be astounded. So I think the more that we can talk about the challenges with that, the better. But frankly, it takes money and it takes lawsuits, unfortunately. And, you know, America's Newspapers has some funds set aside for people, for newspapers who can't afford, and they can, you know, come to us for some support, but it's not nearly enough. And it's unfortunate because I think, you know, you get into the smaller markets. I mean, you know, you're a journalist. You know, I assume you don't have a deep legal fund to go sue people.
Do not. So,
yeah, right. So.
But I mean, you know, part of that too is you look at, you know, they can still, the public entity can still charge us the fees based on old fees to print, collate, and mail that information to us. And you know, is that where associations can kind of somehow try to push back to change those rules? Because, you know, it shouldn't be thousands of dollars to print, collate, and mail me some documents when you could hit a couple buttons.
Yeah, no, that's a great idea. I just got an idea for America's Newspapers marketing staff.
That's my one good idea for the year. I'm done.
It's a good one.
Well, tell me a little bit more about, because you know, I, all of us, you know, this audience is going to be newspaper industry people too, so we can all go for hours on this kind of topic. So I kind of want to move on a little bit and tell me a little bit more about what America's Newspapers is doing and some of the other, I guess, in things that they've got.
Yeah. So, you know, obviously advocacy has been a big piece. Training has been a huge piece for America's Newspapers. And I think that's the one area when I look at from the, you know, the beginning of the pandemic, I think that our group, our staff pivoted really well. And we've hosted dozens and dozens and dozens of webinars, training webinars, from everything from selling remotely to digital subscriptions and digital subscription success, and just a host of topics that, you know, basically it's free to members. The training is free, and the response that we've had has been pretty phenomenal. Last year in particular, and I don't have the specific numbers, but we had record numbers of participants on the training session. So that's really kind of the one of the key focuses is focus. Certainly marketing messages, and you know, you brought up your idea. We provide marketing materials for our member newspapers, from everything about the value of local news to the role that we play within the community to helping sustain and get support for some of these legislative priorities that we have. You know, obviously First Amendment rights are big. And really just trying to keep our members informed of what's going on. You know, I mean, there's so much happening both legislatively and the Section 230 challenges and changes that might be coming. It's a bit of a challenge to stay up with it all, but I think we're doing a really good job of that. The association, the America's Newspapers, started 2 years ago with the consolidation of what was Inland Press Association and Southern Newspaper Publishers Association, SNPA. And I think that, you know, the merging of those two organizations couldn't have been more timely given what we've been dealing with for the last 16 months.
I feel like, you know, one of the, if we can, as we all want to do, is find that silver lining of the last 18 months, right? But I feel like it has helped us, whether you're on editorial side, whether you're on the advertising side, I feel like we were all kind of forced to relearn our basics, right? We've become better reporters. We've become better marketing people. We've had to get better at finding ways to connect our advertisers with the readers. In some ways, I think this has been a push that was needed so that we can do things, like you mentioned 15 minutes ago, try to finally embrace that we're going to have to really shift and embrace digital over the printed products.
Yeah, yep, exactly. You know, just one little example. So now that things are opening up and, you know, we hadn't been doing absolutely no travel. And now the travel requests are starting to come in and it's like, well, let's take a step back and relook at kind of what we did travel for. And this particularly on the news side, you know, do we need to send two photographers to cover a football game because, you know, we need one in each end zone. You know, I think there are things now as a result of what we've learned over the past 16 months, and that's just one of many examples that, you know, my worst fear is we just jump back into whatever we were doing pre-pandemic and we miss the opportunity from the learns that we've had for the last year and a half to kind of make things better for the long haul.
I feel like most of us are taking that broader look as to, like I said, I think it was being forced to get back to the basics, forced to remember how to do the little things really, really well and to show what we do for the community. I mean, you spent, when your reporters did go out, they strapped on helmets and shields and they went out and covered some of the most important stories that community has seen in, you know, a generation, right?
Yeah, definitely so. Yeah. Yep. Yep, and I agree. I think that the nuts and bolts thing is key, and you know, we've all had to relearn how to do our jobs. Basically, is what it's come down to.
Well, I want to be cognizant of your time. I know you have you told me you had another meeting coming up, so I want to wrap things up. But before we do, let's start here. You've got positions available at the Seattle Times. How can they contact your teams?
They can reach out to me or, you know, by my email. So it's going to be somewhere, afisco@seattletimes.com. That would probably be the best and I can filter them. Let's put it that way.
Hey, if people want to connect and follow along with what's going on at America's Newspapers, how can they do that?
America's Newspapers is, newspapers.org is our, website domain. So check it out. There's valuable information there and you can learn about how to become a member. You can, you know, look at some of the marketing materials that we provide, training opportunities. There's a wealth of information there. So that'd be the best place to start.
Well, Alan Fisco, thank you so much for your time today, for giving some insight on the industry and things are going and letting us get a peek into what's happening in Seattle, but also just a big thank you to associations like America's Newspapers, what you guys are doing to advocate for our industry and help us move forward.
Well, we're happy to do it. It's been very rewarding for me personally, and thanks for having me this morning. Appreciate it.
All right. Well, that will wrap us up for this episode. We'll talk to everybody next time.
Take care.
The News Nirvana podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or most any of your favorite podcast apps. The News Nirvana podcast is made possible by the generosity of Town News. Connect with Town News at townnews.com. The News Nirvana podcast is produced by Fredcasts. Think, speak, act.